This is East Ending. Tonight we present poet Lynn Melnick and Rosalind Brenner, recorded in July 2019 at the annual Poetry Marathon at the East Hampton Historical Society's Mulford Farm. We begin with Lynn Melnick reading from Landscape with Sex and Violence.
So before I begin, I'm going to read mostly from my book, which is called Landscape with Sex and Violence, as you heard. I'm going to read a couple of new poems in between because I kind of get sick of myself. A lot of these poems deal somewhat explicitly, or actually explicitly, with sexual violence and just violence. And the language can be rough, too. The book tells the story of my life within... And sort of the traumas that happened to me and sort of living, growing up within rape culture and as a trauma survivor. This one is called Landscape with Smut and Pavement. At night, I hallucinate the grunting discord which leapt from a human body as he destroyed mine. That very month, I obliterated a beetle on a shiny walkway. That month was November. I think they are all out to get me, all the insects in their armor. Some folks like to use the word slut, even with children. I am holding all my blood in vials on my lap. The splatter is delicate. I guess I am bleeding all over the scenery. I was born in November. But you want to hear about the clean stretch of pavement where a beetle once lived, or the surrounding archways that were the kind of architecture that bodies who have been treated gently like to enjoy. The kempt lawn was always kempt. I was disparaged on that terrain. I was smut. The rest was burnished. I have very few skills beyond poetry, but one of them, this is true, is air hockey. I'm really good at air hockey. And when I was a young and messed up kid, I would go to pool halls. I lived in Los Angeles near Sunset. And I would hustle air hockey because I was like this little tiny person. And I would earn money that way because people would be like, oh, you know, obviously I can beat you. And then I would beat them. So this one is called Landscape with B-Side and Air Hockey. You'll be surprised how firmly I can hustle a room full of players twice my age, coming off a pool table to the corner where I stand fondling quarters, waiting for someone to cut me some slack, because the thing is, it's all defensive play on a low-friction surface, and I'm all instinct about a puck, thin disguise. If I tell you that a minor musician in the hall dubs me a cliched bit of flora at a time of day during a weather event and later backs it with power chords, well then, instant replay. I stop the puck at the very last second and knock it back so quick across the humming air that my opponent pries a 20 from his billfold and pulls me through the knot of bandmates to the back room where, jammed between two cabinets, my one desire, I endure my victory. Landscape with Loanword and Solstice. Say yes. So I let him run me to the limits in a pickup, though I know better than to expect the chaparral to grow much through trauma, except in order to withstand extinction, though it appears under the smog supernatural. Cut two. He shoves my face into the flatbed, then punts me when he's filled me. Walk home. And I do. Scrub for miles, the darkest day of the year, moving in and out of comprehension. But I am glad. Hear me? I am glad. Because now it can be over. Consider this canvas of Central Valley splendor, dull as the usual set of sucker punches, his distinctive suggestion for a rainy day. I was crushed over sundry wonders of our topography. Depraved though I was about my body, I hated washing blood from my hair. There is little I am good at. I am good at sitting. That entire winter, I sat outside in a town with too much earth, and I counted whirls slowly, but I kept on with it, my pointless obsession, even though I couldn't splay my sentences damp into dark. I tried to detonate my body differently than he did. But then came the sirens, and then came the paperwork. Betrayed me. Hills of snails. Behind me, how blood sticks to hair. Panorama, There is little I am good for. So I'm going to read two new ones, and then I'll go back to the book. I'm afraid the two new ones aren't any happier than the rest of the book. So this one is called Losing the Narrative. A shattered bottle tore through my hand last month and slit a vein until every finger was purple and I couldn't make even a tentative fist. I used the other hand to indicate, I'm okay. How unwise I am, how polite in a crisis. In triage, an overheard photo of someone's lover almost 3,000 miles west made me seize with longing when I spied a palm tree in the background. I understand what it says about me, that my body lustfully wishes to place itself where it was never safe. I have put enormous energy into trying to convince you I'm fine, and I'm just about there, no? Besides, decades on, poorly healed bones help me to predict rain, though it's true I like to verify weather with another source because I know not to trust myself. I've been told repeatedly I don't have a mind for plot, but it would be a clever twist, wouldn't it, if in the end I realize it's me who does me in? And then this other newish poem I'm going to read. I've found this to be true that when women have children, readers often expect you to write about your children. And they often ask me why I don't write about my children, which is strange because my husband, who's also a poet, never gets asked that question. And yet he does write about the kids, so it's very confusing. No one ever asks him whether or not he does, nothing about the kids, but I get that all the time. So the reason that I didn't write about my kids is because I tend to write about things that I find to be unsolvable or confusing or overwhelming, and I was doing fine with the kids, love the kids, not complicated. And then my older daughter turned 12, and then it was like all hell broke loose. And she's almost 14 now, so like we're right in the middle of it. But we're right in the middle of it. It's almost over. There's not another one who's going to be a teenager soon, too. So suddenly things were very complicated, and so I wrote this poem. This is for my daughter, Ada. It's called 12. When I was your age, I went to a banquet. When I was your age, I went to a bar room and bought cigarettes with quarters lifted from the laundry money. Last night, I did all your laundry. I don't know why. I thought this love could be pure. It's enough that it's infinite. I kiss your cheek when you sleep and wonder if you feel it. It's the same cheek I've kissed from the beginning. You don't have to like me. You just have to let me keep your body yours. It's mine. When I was your age, I went to a banquet, and a man in a tux pinched my cheeks. When I was your age, I went to a bar room, and a man in a band shirt pinched my ass. There's so much I don't know about you. Last night, I skipped a banquet so I could stay home and do your laundry and drink wine from my grandmother's glass. When I was your age, boys traded quarters for a claw at my carcass on a pleather bench while I missed the first few seconds of a song I'd hoped to record on my backseat boombox. When I was your age, I enjoyed a hook. You think I know nothing of metamorphosis, but when I was your age, I invented a key change. You don't have to know what I know. She's going to do something amazing. She's choking on the inspirational music from the nurse tech's radio, something about running and fire, but like it's a good thing, like the fire is what drives all the running, and the running is towards something good and not from something so violent that when it catches her, she ends up here, standing up slowly, blood still trickling down into her sock. It's tinny, she realizes, when she swipes a taste in the elevator on her way out. She passes each of the neat houses with red shingles near the hospital in the posh part of town, and as she moves further away, the shingles take on an ashen color, the color of steak when it first starts to move beyond bloody. It's the color of the newly dying, is what she's trying to say. It's the color of the world with all the bodies dying. She'd meant to make a hook rug. Do you know those? That's the kind of thing people did before computers, the kind of thing girls did before they were forced to in the back of somebody's car. The hook rug was of a reindeer out of season, and one of these seasons she had hoped to be done with it, and she'd lay it on her floor like she'd been laid on the floor before, and she'd lay on top of it, and she'd pull the threads out one by one until her fingers burned and bled, and then she'd rage at herself for the ruin, and then she'd throw the whole ridiculous thing away because whatever made her think she had any talent for domesticity anyway? There's an enduring chart on her. When they need somebody with indefinable eyes, they call her up. They parade her around and inspect her. They don't help her, but they like to stand around with their tongues down each other's throats about how hot they are at rescuing girls. Meanwhile, the blood keeps dripping down her legs. She takes a job in a video store. That's where people located porn before computers. She watches men disappear into the back room, and she wants to tell them she doesn't care what turns them on, but she wishes they wouldn't look crushed when she won't touch their hands at the counter. It's not the worst job. It's just the kind of job you'd expect a girl like her to have, but she doesn't care what you think. She's going to get out of here eventually. She's going to run triumphant circles around all you jerk-offs. She's not bad at basketball, as long as nothing is flying at her face. She likes the way asphalt smells like sweat, smells like rubber. That's the grace of being knocked nose down, that smell which is richer than skin, which suggests there once was victory, even in this defeat. Some nights at the discount laundry prove exciting. This is where she finds herself with a scarf around her neck, holding a tissue just for effect. She's not crying anymore. All her clothes look beige, even when they are the colors she thought would change her life into a life like other people might have when they don't have blood dripping down their legs. A stray gets into the building, and everyone's got something to worry about, and everyone's a hero here because they are also concerned about the dog. But she's taking her clothes out of the dryer and taking her scarf from around her neck and hanging herself, or hoping to, except she's too afraid of heights to climb higher than her height. You maybe imagined her taller when you picture her at night, when you imagine what holding her down was like. More leggy, less bruised about the thighs, about the throat, less hoarse. She walks past the hospital where they long since took her chart and used it to wipe between their legs. The hospital where no one remembers her now that the worst thing that ever happened to her happened in the last century. She stops bleeding. Eventually, even metaphorically, she stops bleeding. She's going to go where no one knows they can't see her. She's going to go where no one is getting high off her suffering, and then she'll be approximating a whole person who may not play good basketball and may not finish a rug in time for gift-giving, but wait, because she's waited. She's going to do something amazing. A man on a park bench wants to tell her a story. It isn't what you're thinking. He wants to tell her about the weeping willow that grew in his boyhood backyard in a different, easier land. And so she listens through his accent and folds and unfolds herself on the bench for most of the afternoon because his voice is gentle and because it's the first time she's learned the name of a tree. It's not that no one ever tried to teach her. It's that she couldn't understand above the screaming. So this one is called Landscape with Blood and Boondocks. All the cats compass out at night to verify my homelessness, though you can't expect me to claw for food while most everyone else is sleeping. I'll just as soon not eat. I don't want anyone to keep me. I'm a set of round, ridiculous things. I talk claptrap in this lush summer land of boondocks. I thumb into somebody's car, and then we see if we can prove every search for my body ends tragically. And you point out a plume I don't care about over the rocks and ruffled around the blood I've lost. I am 13 before I know that ants can nest in a log. 14 before I know that the reproductives have wings. Under stag lights, I dance for my dinner. And everywhere I wander, the cats scratch my legs. I can't stay here. It's over. It was always over. There was never going to be a miracle that would keep me green. This poem, it takes its title from Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights. Poem to remind my heart to beat. No matter the upright life I've been trying to lead, I keep looking for new ways to bluff myself so hard I'm always pleading for relief, frantically trying to locate whatever blunt object would sock me into unconsciousness. I know what it's like to be powerless on a shag rug. When I tell you, come closer, closer, look how pretty I am, come closer, close, I will bury you there in this petri dish of what went wrong, growing in its dozens of gruesome sequences. It's October. Slowly, the web's arch iron railings, the pumpkins appear like cautions, vigilant but motionless. I would like that, my mood stabbed into me, triangle eyes blinking only the fire behind them. Come closer, close, look how pretty, I died on the shag rug, but you still remember me. Autumn never did to me what it did to others, a beauty to admire right before the end. I've been wrinkling, slowly, closer. I need you to cuff me to whatever apparatus will pump the blood into and out of my heart. Cut me open with chill in the air. Carve into me a face that can overtake this unreasonable face. Closer. Take me apart in your arms. I am not any brilliant color, but the dried brown leaf of the season folded over and stepped on by whatever step rushes where any step is rushing to in all these crumpled pieces. And in all these pieces, I am sending myself into the air to see where I land. This is called One Sentence About Los Angeles. I've been trying to plant a palm in every garden I slink through, using this intoxicating body I lucked into some years after I first arrived in the desert in a Datsun with a commonplace finch in the backbench seat with me. And while you're probably waiting for metaphors because you know that's the most respectable skill I have, this is not a story about cages, and it sure isn't a story about wings. And while you are probably waiting for confession because you think that's what I've been doing here all along, this is not a story of how my body was first held down before I'd even hit double digits, on a dingy carpet whose fibers are still on my tongue, whose burn to my cheek I didn't even notice amid the more traumatic injuries until later I saw photos because I couldn't look in the mirror until the 21st century. But this, all of this, the rape and the allegory and the skinny palms sheltering no one, this is the story of how I got to live in a city that had run one course and needed another, roots humping up the walkways, so even sober, we stumbled toward the slowing cars, which is what happens to girls who grow up with all that poetry and carpet in their mouths. But remember, I almost forgot to tell you, I lived in a desert where palms are signposts of water, not the want of it. Thank you.
This is East End Inc. We heard poet Lynn Melnick reading from Landscape with Sex and Violence and other work. At the East Hampton Poetry Marathon in July 2019. Next, Rosalind Brenner reads from her latest collection, Every Glittering Chimera.
I just want to explain that in Greek myth, I'm just going to read it, Chimera was of divine race. Hinder a serpent, in the middle a goat, in the forepart a lion exhaling blazing fire. Always depicted as the feminine, but often a feminine beast. For me and in other definitions, it is also about the mystical. It's about the mystery. It is about something hidden. It's about, for me, women's lives, the quest for meaning in our dual lives of wanting to be spiritual, of wanting to live in this world, all of that. It's about the many-faceted enigma that drives our lives. They're stories, really. They're compressed stories. And the poet in me just feels compelled to express all these ideas in my narrative. This is for Lynn, too. Mm-hmm. Instructions for heart-rending times. If thunder can roar its outrage, if lightning can slice the oak in half, send branches and burnt wood through your window, break glass, shred nerves, why can't you roar your truth? Thunder doesn't have a mouth. Woman, you can bellow louder. If you don't speak, your tongue becomes sand, your art, yard sale junk, trivia to decorate a meaningless wall. A smothered voice cannot be heard. You read the Morning Times, guns shoved into the hands of boys, girls forced to suicide, bombs strapped to little bodies. A victim, quadriplegic, claims he forgives the shooter at the festival. You can't. Your head shakes. Shouts of no vibrate in your bones. This terrifying season's repetition is hard to swallow. Your throat is parched. Is head shaking all you can contribute? Gale winds scream, outside flood, thunder must originate in you. Though the rain is deluge and you're afraid, arise as lightning to pierce the dark. Don't sleep, don't pray, ignite. You once believed in prayer and flowers. Peace petals didn't rain down from the sky. Let your angry woman's voice break out, shred nerves. Resist the urge to hide under the bed. Smash your pretty landscape with thunderclaps. Unbury the blameless dead. The dead do haunt my poems, I have to say, especially in this book. So there are many that are memoiristic, some that are just montage, that are a combination of things I know, things I've heard, other people's lives, my own life. This is The Milliner. It's about my dad. The Milliner. In the good times, Papa left the house at 6 a.m. for his factory on 32nd Street to arrive before his 100 girls who worked machines to manufacture hats. He'd demonstrate stitches and paste they duplicated by the dozens for hats he dreamed of in his sleep and drew on scraps of paper. Hatter to aspiring ladies of Queens and Brooklyn, he made pillboxes that perched on stylish hair, a page boy or a flip, just like Jackie's. Lady Bird scorned hats, broke the industry, rendered his art useless, his pockets empty. But in the early days, always a triumph of invention. Dangling baubles on cloches, dipped brims, Lanaterna style, sexy over one eye, turbans amuck with ersatz gems. My father's palette swirled with glass beads, silk swatches, felt, buttons, ribbons. For mother, he'd bring home satin-lined round boxes packed with hats she fastened to her hair with gleaming rhinestone pins. For me, Dad filled a cardboard carton with scraps I built into worlds, portals made of glass jewels and fabric flowers I spread on the green carpet floor, swept back into the box at day's end, like sand paintings. He disappeared as they did, but first he sewed for me a satin bridal cap, a long white sequin veil, a matching purse of file and lace with rows of perfect pearls. Father comes home from the hat factory. I'm hungry, he says. He mourns his night school education, what he could have done. Thick sweat stifles pores. He wipes his brow, soaking his white handkerchief. Doesn't know his heart will soon betray him on a New York sidewalk. The walls scratch him. Years of sharp stucco paint can't obliterate the gray. Mother tucks the baby into a bed fashioned from a pulled-out dresser drawer. Towels and pillows fluffed. She should have. Could have been an actress. I was beautiful, she says, as she rubs her infant's stomach. Pressure cooker boils over. Father reaches for his glass, crushed ice, cheap scotch, no words. A single bare bulb dangles from the ceiling in the long hallway. Her pierced dream of stardom, his soft marrow dissolve in roiling heat. Family photographs. Two sisters stand close, arms slung across each other's back, long and graceful, paired like a cashmere sweater with well-worn jeans. Their hold on each other tightens, but their lives diverge. One runs through marriages and men, the other a dutiful wife. Picture the scrapbook. Jowls form, necks morph, lines incise skin, each track like seams in antique silk. Fast forward, today one stands alone, veined hands reaching for an empty shadow. Widow. The house rattles absence. She looks around the rooms at the intimacy of what was their mundane domesticity. He collected tools, a basement full of wrenches, pliers, hammers, saws. Everywhere she looks, his neatness. Even the rags are washed and folded. He kept old toasters, investigated screws, kept wing nuts in jars, properly sized. He was a fixer, smoked and tinkered in the cold garage. She hires a team to haul it all away, keeps a few mementos. She could use that hammer, some nails, his gold pocket watch. She hears only the bass note of her own small imprint, knows there is nothing that is not there, and nothing that is. She holds the world responsible, and him. Clumsy in the landscape of alone, she feels vestigial, a thing jilted, left with a blunted pencil and blank paper, resigned to fumbling in the language of grief.
Thank you.
This is East End Inc. We heard poets Lynn Melnick and Roslyn Brenner recorded at the annual East Hampton Poetry Marathon in July 2019. The complete recording is available online at eastendinc.blogspot.com. Lynn Melnick's published work includes Landscape with Sex and Violence in 2017, and If I Should Say I Have Hope in 2012, both from Yes Yes Books. A former fellow at the New York Public Library's Cullman Center for Scholars and Writers, she teaches at the 92nd Street Y and Columbia University. Rosalind Brenner is an artist and poet. Her work includes All That's Left, Poems and Paintings from Art House Press, and Omega's God, a Compendium of Women's Voices from Finishing Line Press. Here are some upcoming free literary events on the East End this summer. On Thursday, August the 1st, at 6 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Meeting House at 977 Bridgehampton Side Harbor Turnpike, Canyon's Cultural Cafe presents Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Paulson Whitehead reading from The Knicker Boys about two young black men enduring the horrors of a Jim Crow-era reform school in 1960s Florida. On Sunday, August the 4th at 5:30 p.m., the Poetry Marathon continues at the Mulford Farm on 10 James Lane in East Hampton. On Thursday, August the 15th at 6 p.m., The Nation editor-publisher Katrina Vandenhuvel and Russia expert Stephen Cohen in conversation about war with Russia, dangers of the new Cold War, and consequences for U.S. politics at Canio's Books, 290 Main Street in Sag Harbor. East End Inc. is heard on the fourth and occasional fifth Wednesday each month. Programs are archived at eastendinc.blogspot.com. All podcasts are available at soundcloud.com. Please search for East End Inc. Today's program was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Dee Slavutin. I'm Hazel Kahn.